Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Today, in Iraq, U.S. Central Command was feeling good. Saddam Hussein is in American hands. Coalition intelligence is making inroads, said top general John Abizaid. U.S. forces raided Sunni insurgent strongholds yesterday and again today in search of resistance fighters. The progress of the past week is encouraging, and Americans and millions of Iraqis are hungry for encouragement. But history warns that determined guerrillas are not easily defeated, even by great powers. Tonight on Point, guerrilla war in history, guerrilla war now in Iraq. We begin in Baghdad with Time magazine correspondent Michael Ware. Ware has recently traveled with resistance fighters and insurgent cells in Iraq. I asked him if the capture of Saddam Hussein appears likely to change the guerrilla threat that Iraqis and U.S. forces are facing there.
Well, it's certainly going to have an impact, but the size and extent of that impact is really the question. I mean, when the news first broke on Sunday afternoon Iraq time, I was with a particular cell of the resistance at a pre-arranged meeting. It just so happened to be at that amazing moment. I got to witness their reactions. Now, once the shock and disbelief wore off, everyone to a man vowed that they would continue the fight. Now, in the days that have followed, the resistance obviously has been somewhat stunned. However, we have seen no let-up in the attacks. There's been any number of suicide bombings. There was a very sophisticated and well-coordinated ambush on an American convoy in the town of Samra, just south of Saddam's ancestral home of Tikrit. It's an ongoing affair. So far, there's been no sign of any real change. However, if you scratch under the surface, we start to see that the resistance is taking stock but reorganizing.
There's a sense, I think, in the U.S. at the moment that there may be a pivot point here, that perhaps the U.S. can ride the momentum of Saddam Hussein's capture and that Iraqis will open up and begin to talk more about neighbors who may be active in resistance, that there may be a scenario in which this can be rolled up in a matter of months. Is that wishful thinking?
I certainly think anything on a time frame such as months would be a matter of us deluding ourselves. It's true there is a momentum. There's a spring in the step of the coalition forces and many of those people who for decades have been opposed to Saddam. But this thing is far, far from over. The resistance has not gone away. Apart from the attacks, they're very much still out there in the communities. We've seen in a number of the hotbed towns, the strongholds of the former regime and now the strongholds of the insurgents, there have been demonstrations, mass demonstrations in favor of Saddam. They have sacked and looted government buildings. There has been skirmishes and small firefights with U.S. forces. The specter of Saddam, this phantom menace on the run from the U.S. military, certainly was a powerful threat or force on anyone who even thought about informing on the insurgents or providing intelligence to the U.S. military. That can't be underestimated. And I think that we're seeing some kind of an upswing, however temporary, in information that may be flowing to the coalition. Certainly the resistance fighters who I've been dealing with in the last few days since Saddam's arrest are much more watchful for what they call spies or collaborators. These are really the simple Iraqis who have had enough and are willing to talk. So the resistance very much is alert to this. However, at the end of the day, the threat from a ghostly, mysterious figure who eventually emerged from a hole is not what is at the end of the day causing people to bite their tongue. What it is the fact that the man three houses down or two farms away is an active member of the resistance. And you, the Iraqi, you know this. It's not Saddam who's going to come and get you. It's not a fear of his government coming back one day, although that has now been greatly alleviated. What it is that man and his friends coming to you in the middle of the night. And that has been happening, and I fear it will continue to happen.
So, Michael, who are the members of this resistance? And I don't mean to suggest that they're all of one stripe, but characterize the root structure of this insurgency. Who's in there?
Well, we have a broad spectrum of anti-coalition, anti-American fighters or forces out there. At one end of the extreme, you have your aggrieved Iraqi. This is a man who is just tired of what he calls the occupation and the indignity that comes with that. It's just inevitable by the very nature of a military occupation. This is a man who perhaps one of his relatives has been caught up in an American operation and arrested. Now, these people disappear into American-controlled prisons and they're just not heard of for months and months and months. There are thousands of families eagerly awaiting word of their loved ones. And as a U.S. official at one of these prisons privately conceded to me, he said, "We have plenty of bad guys in here, but we also, I know to my heart, have people here who were just in the wrong place at the wrong time." Mm-hmm. So these are the relatives and the people who are picking up a weapon and taking a shot at a U.S. convoy. At the other end of the extreme, we're now seeing the new generation of the resistance. After the war, they were scattered, dispersed. They had to lick their wounds. Well, they've licked them, and they've healed to a large degree. They're coming together. These are ex-military officers, ex-intelligence officers, security staff. They're forming cells. They started off acting individually as groups. Now they're coming together as cohesive military units in small, well-disciplined, well-trained guerrilla armies where you have a number of cells acting in concert, answering up a chain of command and receiving directives down that chain of command. Beyond that, we have foreign fighters. Now, the foreign fighter element has been overstated time and time again. However, it's still real. The numbers are small. Often they're just men full of fervor, religious anger, who have been fired up at their mosque and have crossed the border. Many of them have no training and no weapons. The organized resistance won't touch these men. They say we can't trust them, we don't know them, and they don't have the skills. The other aspect to the foreign element is even smaller. It's more minute, but these are the hardcore terrorists. It doesn't take many to make an impact. It's believed that these are the men behind the suicide bombings and the larger, more politically orientated strikes that are causing most of the civilian casualties. These men are operating, but with Iraqi logistics support. For example, the UN bombing in the summer. That was a truck laden with 1,500 pounds of old munitions and bombs. Mm-hmm. Now, the foreigners could not collect them themselves, but they're the ones who drove the truck into the UN.
So within that mixed bag, Michael, is there evidence of coordination, or is it just a kind of organic resistance that's shared across this spectrum?
It certainly began as something that was very much organic. But now we're starting to see increasing degrees of sophistication within these separate groups and to some degree between the separate groups. You're not going to find very often Iraqis fighting side by side with foreigners. That, as the military admits, is a rarity. However, there is a coordination of attack. I believe from what I'm hearing, it may even be a loose division. Well, you go for the political targets. You hit the UN and the embassies. We'll focus on our bread-and-butter battle, which is with the American convoys and the American bases.
And what about the American troops' response to all this? Are they becoming more effective in targeting cells? And the overall strategy, is it becoming more effective in removing both the means and the motivation for insurgency?
There certainly has been a momentum over the past month to the U.S. military's operations. We've seen Iron Hammer and a number of other large-scale operations, which were designed to send a message. And initially, I don't believe that they were successful in picking up too many individuals or too many groups, but the overwhelming firepower that was unleashed was a reminder of what's in store. However, since then, and particularly since the arrest of Saddam Hussein and the documents of high intelligence value that were found with him, there has been a new surge, a new lease of life upon the anti-insurgency operations. And we're starting to see some cells, almost in their entirety, being picked up, and some of the financiers. However, I have been with some of these cells or some of these organizations through communications and meetings during the course of some of these operations, even the ones that are underway now, some of these highly successful ones. And the groups that I have been with, the groups that I have physically seen, have so far been untouched, and their entire organizations remain intact. So it's going to be a long, hard journey to uproot all of these things. And as for the motivations, well, to some degree, we're not even addressing those. The queues for gasoline here in Baghdad stretch for kilometers. Power is still an on-again, off-again issue. Many of the basics of life, those things are improving little bit and little bit, day by day. Overall, there is still a great sense of dissatisfaction, and there's still a foreign occupier here. So to some degree, we're not addressing the motivations. We're attacking the means, but not the why.
And from all that comes continued guerrilla resistance. Michael Ware, thanks for your work in Iraq and Baghdad, and thanks for joining us this evening.
Tom, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Michael Ware is a correspondent for Time magazine. He spoke with us from Baghdad. We're talking tonight about guerrilla warfare in history and now in Iraq. Do you feel a tide turning? Do you think the insurgents in Iraq have staying power? If guerrilla attacks continue, even for years, does the U.S. have the determination to go the distance? What history lessons might be most useful to Washington right now? What lessons might Iraqi insurgents be boning up on? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Chevy Chase, Maryland, is Jay Winnick, historian and author of the New York Times bestseller April 1865, The Month That Saved America. He is senior scholar of history and public policy at the University of Maryland. Good evening and welcome, Jay Winnick.
It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. Also with me in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, good to have you here.
Nice to be here. And hello, Jay.
Yeah, nice to hear your voice.
Jay Winnick, Jack, you just listened along with us, Jay, to Michael Ware checking in from Baghdad saying, watch out. Yes, the capture of Saddam will have an impact, but there's a lot more going on here than just that one guy. There's a lot we want to hear about history from you tonight, but give us your just top-line assessment first. From Iraq, Americans in the field are expressing some optimism this week, a lot of very vigorous raids going on just in the last day or two. What are you feeling about the U.S. effort there vis-a-vis the guerrillas?
Right. My sense is both sentiments are right. That on one hand, it's just an enormous boost to have captured Saddam Hussein, who was the symbolic head of the resistance. But by the same token, it's really crucial to take stock of the reality on the ground, and it's quite clear that we are not out of the woods yet. And while we are, as you put it, and I think quite rightly, at a pivot point, it's unclear how that pivot point will play out. And perhaps it could play out in such a way that this could really sort of signal the beginning of the end, and how long it will take to get to the end remains to be seen. Or on the other hand, it could be the just another stage of a very long and tough journey in which this thing festers for years to come.
You've looked at a lot of guerrilla warfare over many centuries. What's your gut feeling here? Do great powers, do they grab for evidence that they're almost out of this thing? Is this of kinship with long-term guerrilla efforts, or is this something that might be different, that might be doable in the next 9 months, in the next year, less?
Yeah, I think it's doable, but I'm not sure it's doable in 6 to 9 months. Ultimately, what I think is the most important point to remember is that throughout history, the success of quelling guerrilla movements, particularly if we're going to quell them within a reasonable time frame, it comes not solely or not simply from military measures, important as those military measures might be, but ultimately it's going to come down to the political situation. And if the political situation can be structured in such a way that they can, the Iraqis with our assistance, can create a pluralistic representative society in which most Iraqis feel a kind of pride of place, then I think it is not only possible but doable that the guerrillas could be reduced to kind of these rogue bandits on the margins, not unlike, say, Jesse James was after the American Civil War.
Rogue bandits on the margins. Jack, it's been more the military face than the political face making progress in the last few days here. Saddam coming out of the hole, these raids in Samarra today.
Yes, what bothers me is the possibility that the political answer, democracy, is in fact an irritating factor. especially for the Sunni minority.
The political answer itself may be a provocation.
That's right, yeah.
Jack, stand by. Jay Winnick, stand by. We're talking tonight about guerrilla war in history, guerrilla war in Iraq. You can join our conversation, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is... I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about guerrilla war in history, guerrilla war in Iraq, about the patterns, the lessons, legacy of guerrilla warriors taking on great powers. My guest tonight is Jay Winnick. He joins us from Chevy Chase, Maryland. He's a historian and author of the New York Times bestseller April 1865, The Month That Saved America. You can join this conversation as well. Do you think the insurgents in Iraq have staying power? And if the guerrilla war there goes on, maybe for years, does the United States have staying power? Are you seeing some light at the end of the tunnel this week? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jay Winnick, we should make this very current. The reports just coming out of Iraq in the last hour or two are about this very big U.S. operation about Samarra, 60 miles north of Baghdad. 2,500 U.S. troops there, three brigades, two surrounding the town, another brigade fanning out in groups of 14. This is described as, you know, blast after blast after blast. They are really knocking down doors there with sledgehammers and crowbars and Bradley armored vehicles. Soldiers going in with satellite positioning devices to locate buildings pre-marked as targets. Apache helicopters overhead. Lots of banging, lots of booms, lots of arrests, 70 or 80 insurgents in the last 24 hours. Lots of weeping and wailing described here by the Associated Press among women and children there as all this goes on. It is not a tidy business addressing an insurgent campaign, Jay Winnick.
No, it's not. And what's clear is what they're doing is they're trying to capitalize on the recent intelligence that they've gotten, and they're trying to move as quickly as possible. And from everything you're saying, to ensnare some of the lead insurgents. But it is an untidy business. And, you know, if one were to look to other campaigns, for example, the Brits waged a successful campaign against the Malayan communists in the 1950s. And if we look at why were they successful, well, on one hand, they were successful because they had superior technology, they had patience, and they had persistence over the course of this long 12-year war. But by the same token, what really ultimately worked was they learned how to work with the people, with the locals themselves. And again, if I were to sort of say one thing tonight, that one lesson from history more than anything else, that ultimately will be the sort of the key on which this whole thing is unlocked.
But the British had been in Malaya then for many years.
Yes.
I mean, they knew that territory very well as colonial overlords.
That's right. That's right. They sure did.
Americans kind of rolled into Iraq in numbers, 8 months ago?
Yeah, no. There's no doubt. This is a great experiment, and we're watching it unfold before our very eyes. And, you know, we had a very sort of interesting with Michael Weir reporting from Baghdad to give us a sense of the kind of the tempo, the mood, the diversity of the insurgents themselves. And it's clear that they have a number of different motivations. Now, against that, we also know that there are Iraqis who welcome us being there and would like to see the experiment succeed. Who will prevail will ultimately turn down to sort of where are the greatest forces of nationalism. And that remains to be seen.
Whether nationalism lines up with the reform effort backed by the United States or with the antagonists of the United States.
And I think it's quite likely that we'll see sort of manifestations of both. But what we have to do is very quickly and very effectively and forcefully, in tandem, we have to have two tracks. We have to have a military track, which is combined of intelligence, which is combined of quick strikes, which is combined of decapitation as much as possible. But by the same token, this political track is going to decide whether or not we are ultimately successful.
And what if, as Jack Beatty suggests, the political reforms themselves, i.e. an effort to install democracy here, is a fundamental provocation to the Sunni population, which has been a minority in power in Iraq?
Yeah. Well, it remains to be seen just how forceful the Sunnis themselves will be. I mean, we don't have enough intelligence, I think, yet on just sort of the staying power of the Sunnis themselves. If indeed they are so disgruntled, this thing could fester on for years. I mean, one of the things that we clearly should be doing is finding a way to sort of reincorporate those Sunnis back into society and say that you have a privileged pride of place in the new Iraqi society as well. That's something that has been done, that was done, for example, after the American Civil War. At the end of the Civil War, when Robert E. Lee said no to guerrilla warfare, Abraham Lincoln was very, very clear and very forceful in saying both to his cabinet as well as to his generals, we have to make sure that we become countrymen again. And
that was done at some cost to America's former slaves. It doesn't seem that the Shiites are likely to play that role waiting for a civil rights movement a century from now. Jay Winnick, we talk a lot about the circumstances in Iraq, and they are unfolding, and they are quite fascinating. I mean, even tonight, this report again from the Associated Press saying senior U.S. military officials are talking about the signs of central planning by former officials of Saddam's regime, coordinating strikes hundreds of miles apart, providing cash, providing bomb-making expertise. But we want to get some of your historical perspective tonight. You've looked across a big sweep of time here. Help us with some examples that may be good learning points for us tonight, and the patterns, the lessons from other guerrilla conflicts over a great span of time that we might want to have in the back of our minds as we look at Iraq. What would you point to?
Right. Well, I think the first point I would make is simply that guerrilla tactics have literally gone back to the beginning of time. And it's not something new. It's been used. It's really been used for a time span of over 2,000 years. And no less than one of the greatest generals that history has known, Napoleon. Well, when he waged a war against guerrillas in the Iberian Peninsula, and at one point, guerrillas were tying down three of Napoleon's armies. And this went on for a number of years, and in a fit of pique at one point, and this was before he ultimately withdrew, Napoleon referred to this as his Spanish ulcer. And there was one very dramatic report that was written to him by one of Napoleon's aides in which it said, quote, we are clinging to dreams to think that we can put down these people.
Even the mighty Napoleon against Lusitanians and Celtiberians.
Right. And let's take another example. If you go back to the British Empire at the turn of the 20th century from 1899 to 1902, 1903, and again, that was at the height of its power. Mm-hmm. They commanded the greatest force perhaps in the world, except for maybe the United States. And they waged a war against the Boers. And in that war, the Boers started out with conventional tactics. But as time went by, they increasingly moved over to guerrilla and terrorist tactics. And it was very much like the story of what we're hearing today. There was a learning curve in the guerrillas. They got better at what they were doing.
They watched the superpower. They watched the British Empire respond.
Right. They watched. They learned. They decentralized. And they realized they didn't have to use conventional tactics. And the whole essence of guerrilla warfare, and it's a surprisingly simple principle, but it works with striking clarity. It's how to concentrate strength against weakness, how to use surprise, how basically to sort of erode the morale of the other side. And the bottom line, I mean, ultimately what we see is what guerrillas try to do is they try to erode the staying power. They try to erode the greater power in such a way that at one point they say the agonies of winning are not worth it.
It's the casualties, the demoralization, the exhaustion that they're trying to create in the big power.
Yeah, I mean, at a certain point there comes to be a great question where denied of the fruits of closure, denied of the legitimacy of victory, it seems that the cruelties of guerrilla war just become no longer worth it. You know, there was a very kind of poignant a dispatch that was sent from France while they were trying to put down a resistance in North Africa in 1833. And this is very telling. In this dispatch, the commissioner wrote, "We have surpassed in barbarity the barbarians we came to civilize." Mm-hmm. And that's another one of the problems of guerrilla war, one that's not talked about nearly enough, which is the fact if guerrilla war is allowed to fester, or if you're unable to put down the guerrillas, over time the two sides can become almost indistinguishable from each other, and almost a collective sociopathy reigns.
In the barbarity, you're saying, in the level of violence. I mean, certainly in the Middle East, we've seen that played out.
But not only in the Middle East, we've actually seen it played out in our own history.
Yes.
During the American Civil War in Missouri, there was a full-scale guerrilla war taking place.
This was a pro-slave state, but not part of the Confederacy, kind of a real mishmash quilt.
It was a real mishmash. And the very fabric of society broke down to such an extent that on one hand you had terrorists who would be riding around wearing necklaces of human ears and teeth and scalps, all of signs of their latest conquest.
Sounds like Liberia, but it was Missouri.
It wasn't. That's exactly right. And then in turn, the union troops became every bit as ruthless and almost psychopathic. And at one point, Lincoln mourned. He said, everything we do pours fuel in the fire. Nothing we do works. And there was an editorial that was written at the time in which it said there was something about the collective humanity in the state that has totally snapped, and it snapped on both sides.
Jack Beattie, I want to put this to you. There clearly has been the desire, the will, the deliberate effort in the Pentagon to use speed in all portions of this interaction with Iraq to kind of leap over this morass. Nobody wants to get tied down in that kind of endless, barbarizing guerrilla conflict. The hope that step by step we can, you know, we can walk on stilts through this. We can speed into Baghdad. We'll capture Saddam. Took longer than was planned. We'll push ahead with the political reform, and we will skip this big guerrilla war. And who wouldn't pray that that can happen? But can it?
Can it? Yeah, that's the question. You can't grade this. This occupation has been lost thus far. This has been a disaster right from the beginning. The decision in May to disband the Iraqi army was, as many people have pointed out, catastrophic.
Paul Bremer's decision as soon as he arrived.
And now the effort to revive it, that seems to be foundering because they weren't being paid enough. So I don't have any confidence, to tell you the truth, in this Pentagon and in this leadership to be able to handle this assignment, partly because I don't think the secretary's heart is in it. I don't think Rumsfeld's heart is in this. And I think the subversion and the self-subversion of this campaign that's been going on right from the start, where he has pulled this rug out from people and then gone along with decisions like Bremer's and
sidelined General Shinseki when he wanted 100,000 more troops.
Absolutely. I mean, I just think that there's some unresolved issue there where the secretary seems to think. In fact, Hillary Clinton said this. She said she had been talking to army people over there who said that they didn't want to ask for more troops because they didn't want the brass, they didn't want Rumsfeld to think this had a military solution. In other words, we don't want them to think we can solve this because we can't. This is a political problem. So there's all this kind of tension between the army and the civilian leadership, between Rumsfeld and his deputy Wolfowitz, so I just think there are really fundamental problems here with the strategy right from the center.
And interestingly, just in the last 24 hours, Rumsfeld saying the information flow from the debriefing of Saddam will not come from the Pentagon. It will come from the CIA. So look for your fresh information there. On the other hand, Jack, for all the problems here and for all the time it took, those troops looked pretty competent pulling Saddam Hussein up out of that almost invisible hole, you know, needle in the haystack of Iraq the other night. I mean, that looked like pretty good soldiering, though it took a while to get there.
Yes, and you know, they had someone tell them, and that's a police kind of function. That's an intelligence sort of function.
But a very successful one, finally, on that night. Jay Winnick, Jack, stand by. I want to invite our callers in. A lot of them want to join us. Dale is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Dale. You're on the air.
Hi, I have a question for the historical perspective. From my understanding, a lot of the successful insurgencies, the main reason they're successful is because they have major foreign backing, everything from Vietnam mm-hmm. to the American Revolution and throughout history. And I'm wondering how much that holds true through the lesser-known guerrilla insurgencies and whether or not the guests think that the insurgents within Iraq have enough foreign backing to actually succeed?
That's a very interesting question. Jay Winnick, let me put it to you.
Yeah. Let me make 2 points about that. Firstly, we have to ask, what does it really mean to succeed?
That is, for the guerrillas to succeed.
Guerrilla success doesn't necessarily mean they win. It could mean they could simply just frustrate the reconciliation and the nation building. And in which case, everybody loses. They have the worst of all worlds, neither war nor peace. This is ongoing drama of sort of death and bloodshed.
Well, but does everybody lose? Does Al-Qaeda lose if Iraq is a mess?
I mean, in a sense, I think everybody does. Well, Al-Qaeda doesn't necessarily lose, but I think it could certainly be said that the Iraqi people would lose.
Certainly.
Now, having said that, do you necessarily need outside help? Throughout history, as a general rule, it has helped when you've had outside assistance, but it's by no means required. For example, if you look at when France and Algeria, the Algerians increasingly resorted to really sort of barbaric tactics. A form of warfare that was almost unthinkable, a form of terrorism that was almost unthinkable. But these spectacular acts of terrorism were what ultimately would erode the will of the French to the point where they eventually said, this is simply not worth a candle. It's simply not worth the game. Having said that, let's step back for a second. I mean, Jack Beatty is a very shrewd observer of events. And he's certainly right that, you know, maybe Don Rumsfeld's heart is not totally in this.
But how can that be? He's Secretary of Defense. Doesn't it have to be in it?
Well, I think in Rumsfeld's case, I mean, he feels that there's only so much he can do. But what is also clear is the president's heart is in this.
Is in this.
Yeah, I think that is an important point to make.
Very explicitly.
I mean, I think he's very committed. He's put his own prestige on the line. And so to the extent that Rumsfeld may be of two minds about what role the Pentagon can play, and to the extent that we're also seeing a great deal of bureaucratic bickering and infighting, I mean, this is not unusual.
But how can Rumsfeld elaborate on that? If his heart weren't in it, then what would he be expecting would come out of Iraq? I mean, isn't it a mess that the Army is saying, you know, the U.S. military is being chewed up by this. We can't take this. We need a solution here. Even at this present troop level, if there were another conflict to break out in Korean Peninsula, you name it. I mean, this is making real problems for the military that he oversees. How does he have the option of not having his heart in it? What might that mean?
Yeah. Well, it may be something that less that one doesn't quantify on the ground. But he's probably sort of sending these sort of gentle signals, or maybe not so gentle. He's saying he wants to see other efforts, including on the political track, to sort of ultimately sort of bring some kind of closure to this. But he is also making the point that he doesn't feel militarily they can win this with just troops alone on the ground and more troops on the ground. I mean, there's been a big debate, should there be more than the numbers that are in? And that's gone back and forth. And what he's saying is, no, that we need better intelligence. We need to Iraqify the process. We need to get the Iraqi army rebuilt.
Not just brute force. And one more touch on Dale's question.
Yeah.
He's asking about foreign support. What's your assessment of the foreign support that is or may come into Iraq? Is it sufficient to qualify between, you know, foreign fighters coming in, potentially foreign money coming in? I'm reading Bruce Hoffman of RAND today saying there may be $3 million a month coming into Iraq from al-Qaeda now.
Right.
I don't know.
Right, right. Well, you know, actually, let me put it a different way, because it's a fascinating and indeed it's one of the most important questions. And I'm going to expand and change the question a little bit about foreign help, not just military help. But if you look back historically, or if you think of what's taking place, I'm sorry, if you think of what's taking place right now, who really wants the Iraqi democratic experiment to succeed? I mean, my guess is if you were to expand around and sort of go to each of the different Middle Eastern countries, you would find very few of them who would say, we want to see a democratic experiment succeed. And it's not unlike, in a sense, what happened during the French Revolution, where all the monarchs and kings and the dictators of Europe did everything they could to quell that democratic revolution rather than see republicanism triumph.
On the other hand, they know Washington is watching closely, so how do those frowns translate? Jay Winnick, Jack Beatty, stand by. We're talking about guerrilla war tonight. 1-800-423-8255 to join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about guerrilla war in history and guerrilla war in Iraq, about the lessons, the patterns, the legacy of guerrilla warriors taking on great powers. Our guest tonight is Jay Winnick. He's author of April 1865, The Month That Saved America. He's a senior scholar in history and public policy at the University of Maryland. Jack Beatty is with me in the studio tonight as well, and you can join our conversation. What history lessons are most useful for Washington right now in Iraq? Vietnam was lost. Does this look like a guerrilla war that can be won? And what's your level of confidence tonight that Washington and Iraq's reformers will prevail? And these are not academic questions tonight. Again, the story is just coming in over the wires. Loud blasts in Samarra, north of Iraq, from dawn until well into mid-morning. U.S. troops swarming everywhere, Bradley fighting vehicles knocking down the door, sledgehammers. It's dirty work doing what has to be done. Here they're describing U.S. soldiers with some Iraqi in a headlock, punching him in the head, saying, "You're dead, you're dead, you're dead." This is tough, hard work that we're asking U.S. soldiers to do. Where's it headed? Is it on the right track? Stephen is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Good evening. I'm calling to ask about the use of propaganda in guerrilla warfare and how your guest feels that it is being well used or not well used in Iraq now.
Give us a little more context for your question, Stephen. How do you see the propaganda around this?
Well, I guess from afar it seems rather ham-fisted, perhaps not from the reality that you cite about what guerrilla war requires, but just the foreign policy aspects of the government seem to be not very well received in that part of the world, and we don't seem to have gone through an alignment since the Cold War about setting things up so that we are trusted in the region.
So, and sort of articulating and presenting a case for the presence there. Jay Winnick, how about it? How important is propaganda? How do you see it playing out in this conflict?
Yeah, propaganda or just the public message. I mean, all that's terribly important, and that, of course, we get to the question or the matter of what is the extent and the degree to which we can bring in Europeans and other allies, or the international community to sort of make a case that we really want you to succeed and we are with you, and so it doesn't seem like an imperial effort. Or it doesn't allow the insurgents or the guerrillas to say this is part of an imperial occupying effort. You know, if we look at an example of where there was a successful, where we successfully put down guerrillas, in 1989 when the Khmer Rouge sought to come back to power in Cambodia in the wake of Vietnam's withdrawal, one of the things that happened is they lacked a widespread support among most of the countrymen after the terrible bloodbath that had taken place in the killing fields. Mm. And B, the international community basically banded together and did everything it could to sort of say that we want to see a more representative government. And the reasons why a representative pluralistic society is so important, or we could say democracy, is because a society in which the animosities are channeled into politics as opposed to hatred and warfare is an effective society. But one should not minimize the degree to which that's difficult. Historically, if you look at just our own country, we were founded in 1776. We had independence shortly thereafter by 1783. But by 1787 and 88, we had to totally change our government. Because it was so precarious. You know, in our own Constitution, it is telling that nowhere is the word nation exist because for the Founding Fathers, they couldn't even agree that we were a nation. That's why they resorted to that more ambiguous phrase, which we now know of as the United States.
And you're talking about a decade there after a decade and more after a Declaration of Independence.
After the Declaration of Independence. And they had to totally change their government, and they still had concerns. It's equally noteworthy that even at that point, nowhere did they talk about America lasting in perpetuity because they didn't know if we could.
So it's a lot to ask Iraq to get it all together politically in the space of months or even a few years.
It really is a little unfair to sort of say that this has to be an overnight process. It's going to be a process that's going to takes quite some time.
And yet, if it doesn't go quickly, you really are putting strains on all kinds of fronts here. What about the other side of Stephen's question? How would you assess the propaganda effort, if we can speak of such a thing, of the guerrillas, of the insurgency in Iraq? Is there propaganda there or not?
Well, just from reading the newspapers, it's my sense that they are not getting a windfall or blowback from propaganda on their behalf, but what Michael Weir was suggesting at the top of the hour is that there's a kind of learning curve, that they're becoming better organized or getting their act together. And so one would suspect that over time, along with the military, as they kind of sharpen their kind of guerrilla tactics, they'll probably sharpen their political edge as well. But that really, again, gets back to my fundamental point that ultimately the success or failure of this great experiment in Iraq will rise on whether or not we can sort of have a kind of pluralistic society and we can sort of jumpstart that process along with or without the rest of the international community's help.
Stephen, thanks for your call. Jack Beattie, how are you seeing this whole area of the contest of to define what's going on in Iraq?
Well, I think that the entire communications situation in the Middle East has changed. Al Jazeera now is a major fact. And what we report
this is
in
the Arab satellite television
all
network.
The details
right.
You just gave about the doors being broken down, the screaming women, the man being hit on the head. This is just a detail to us. In an Al Jazeera story, that is right at the front.
The grinding boot of oppression,
that
practically.
That goes out to millions every single day across the region.
Even if it's presented to the United States as effective, aggressive crackdown on guerrillas who deserve a crackdown.
That's what Rumsfeld, of course, was worried about. Are we creating more guerrillas than we are destroying? And what creates them precisely is that propaganda which is called, in some ways, the truth, right?
There's one that can take a lot of defining, seen many different ways. Rob's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Rob, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question with the comparisons you're drawing between past guerrilla warfare affecting conquering forces. Isn't this case kind of different in that, well, allegedly anyway, we're trying to not rule them for our own benefit, but to overthrow a dictator and get them to form their own government?
Well, I guess if people completely buy that in Iraq and the Middle East, then it should be. But you point to, Rob, exactly what Jay and Jack are talking about here, is that there's a kind of contest to define what's actually going on. Jay, is that the fulcrum here? If everyone can be persuaded that this is in fact for Iraq's own good, and is the Middle East, is Iraq persuadable, given its colonial history?
Yeah. Well, I think they're persuadable, but are they persuadable in the time frame in which success, so it doesn't get to that point where there's this kind of neither war nor peace situation, and really everybody loses. And what we don't know, and we really don't know this yet, is the effect of 30 years of this kind of bloody totalitarian rule and the effects of this murderous dictator has had on society. And to get into the hearts and the minds of the people of Iraq is very difficult to do. And I think they themselves are probably a little bit nervous about this. And that's why what the military can do is they can provide the political breathing space, but politically that message has to be there. And the Iraqis have to sort of believe it themselves that they can emerge out of this, and it can be an Iraq in which all Iraqis have some kind of pride of place.
That this really is for them. Rob, thanks for your call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Ricardo is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Ricardo. You're on the air.
The whole thing sickens us to the very depths of our soul. I want to ask Jack Beatty a question, and then permit me to make a remark. Jack, how on earth did the American people inherit the mantle of Nazi Germany here in the so-called Christmas holy season?
What do you mean exactly by that, Ricardo?
Well, this evil empire has taken over Germany's attempt at world domination. I don't think anybody can deny that, even Winnick. But, Jack, how did this happen? How have the American people bought into this empire? It's just, you know, bashing down doors and killing people here in the Christmas season. And I'll say this about empire and resistance. This will never succeed from the point of view of Rumsfeld and his gang. The Islamic peoples will fight to the bitter end. They remember the Crusades. The more you kill them, the more they will want to go to heaven by killing the Americans. So they will win, and this will be the downfall of the American empire.
Ricardo, we'll turn to Jack on that, but of course the message is we're trying to hand you democracy on a silver platter, Iraq.
Yeah, sure. Who believes that crap, those lies, democracy? Even little Jay, the way he says it's a democratic experiment, I don't think even he can believe it.
Ricardo, we've got it. Jack Beatty.
Well, I reject the Nazi parallel, but I certainly understand the passion Ricardo is feeling about the course the country has taken through this war. You know, George Kennan said years ago that the American people are a little bit like dinosaurs in the slime, in the primeval ooze, and they're just there going along, and suddenly something happens, and that great creature gets up, and he lays about him with his tail and with his tongs, and he gets out of that primeval ooze and starts stomping around, and that, I'm afraid, is what sort of happened to us after September 11th. We were all asleep, and now we're all awake. And the president says this is the battlefield of the war on terror. And so long as Americans accept that, that somehow this is the battle, part of the battle that began on September 11th, it seems to me the public is going to cut an awful lot of slack for what Al Jazeera will depict as brutality and for what may well be brutality in many instances. We were attacked, and this has given authority to our retaliation, even if people could argue, and I would argue, it's the wrong target.
Jay Winnick, Ricardo asks, how could America do this? What about the political will at home? That's surely another large piece of this. Do you see it as deep? Do you see it as durable?
Yeah. Yeah, I think post 9/11, and I say this because I've done a lot of traveling around the country. I've done two national book tours, and just my instincts suggest to me that on the whole, the majority of the American people are really going to cut the president a lot of slack in this case, and I would agree with Jack on that point. Whether one agrees with it or one disagrees with it, I think the American people feel there's a menace out there. This has been now coupled with the question of 9/11, and I think there's a lot of political leeway, unless something really dramatic or drastic takes place. But even if that were to happen, there's always a tendency for the American people to rally around the flag and the president. So I think we've got some time. It's just, do we use that time well? Do we use it wisely? Do we use it effectively? Going back to the Napoleon example, you know, Marx once said, for Napoleon, it was like the lion in the fable, tormented to death by the gnat. And that's what we don't want to have happen.
Mm. Michael Ware described earlier a kind of a picture of neighbor on neighbor in Iraq, that maybe people still wouldn't feel free to stand up and point fingers at insurgents, right, that they'd feel threatened. I mean, you've written a lot about Missouri, where you had houses and towns torched, trains and stagecoaches attached, steamboats under repeated sniper fire. That sense of a culture that's really torn between what it believes the future is or ought to be, where neighbor fears neighbor, does that feed guerrilla conflict in Iraq?
Absolutely. Not only does it feed it, it creates this kind of never-ending maelstrom in which everybody loses. And if you go back to the Missouri example, what enabled us to sort of both quell that on one hand and avoid that sort of becoming enlarged was there was a leader on the southern side, Robert E. Lee, who commanded the authority and the respect of the people of the South. And he decisively said no to guerrilla war. There was also a clear-cut victory by the Union. And in that case, I mean, the verdict was there. And what the hope would be is that we can find or cultivate or nurture, or the Iraqis themselves out of their own populace will arise leaders who will both say no to this kind of a situation, and we'll have the confidence and the respect of the different sort of segments of the Iraqi people. And if that were to happen, then it could be successful. And what it is going to take, though, it's going to take Iraqi leadership, not really just sort of American military might on its own.
Jay Winnick, we thank you for your perspective tonight, and thank you for joining us.
I was delighted to be here. Thanks much.
Jay Winnick, author of April 1865, The Month That Saved America, senior scholar in history and public policy at the University of Maryland. Jack Beatty, these sound like long-term projects.
Oh, they do, and inevitably with the tattoo of brutality on both sides if it goes on.
It's part of the picture. Listeners, you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.